Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'm going to go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, did the tourism minister follow due process in removing the board of South African Tourism? The sports minister under fire over historic social media posts? The RAND showing resilience in the face of tariff shocks? And communication dead zones put public safety at risk? It's Monday, the 25th of August. Now, the sudden dissolution of the South African Tourism Board is raising sharp questions about governance, continuity, and I also would throw into that mix ministerial overreach. The Institute of Directors in South Africa says board should never be left unable to act simply because a chairperson steps down, and that King IV clearly sets out mechanisms to ensure stability. But with the big tourism in Durba just weeks away, the collapse is triggering wider concerns about how public entities are being run and whether due process is being followed. In that respect, I am joined by the chief executive of the Institute, Professor Pami Natasan. Pami, from a governance perspective, and welcome to you, what's your biggest concern about how this dissolution was handled?
Thanks, Jeremy. Yeah, I guess the crux of this matter is really that we're told that the chairperson of the SA Tourism Board stepped down a few weeks before this meeting of contention happened. And look, the Tourism Act is clear. It says the minister appoints the board, and the minister also, by the way, appoints the chair and deputy directly, unlike other boards where shareholders appoint a board and the board themselves choose their chair. So what this really means is there was a casual vacancy on the board at the time. The Act also says that the minister appoints people to fill a vacancy, but it gives no time frame, nor does it give any transitional arrangements. So the minister could take as long as they want to appoint a new chair. And in the meantime, how does the board function? It does not seem that there's any requirement for the minister to then nominate someone as acting chair in the meantime for the board to be able to do their job. Funny enough, the exact same act in section 26 refers to the board being able to nominate someone as an acting CEO if a casual vacancy arises for the position of CEO. So similarly for the role of chair, which is also a very key governance role, why not have a similar provision so that the board can continue functioning? I just feel this board was between a rock and a hard place. Imagine you're functioning as a board, you're in office, you have the fiduciary duties to act in the best interest of this organization. Information comes to your attention about the CEO, serious information. You have an obligation to hold the CEO to account. And now you're sitting with, do we call a meeting or do we not? If you didn't call the meeting, then I would argue that someone else would come from another angle of the law and say you were negligent and didn't fulfill your duty as a board member at that time. Now they call the meeting and then are told, well, they weren't allowed to because the Act says the chairperson may convene a special board meeting. Now, I feel this is form over substance. The Act may say the chairperson may convene, but I don't think the Act ever intended or envisaged that there wouldn't be a chairperson for a period of time.
So how does this fit into the King IV principles?
Well, King IV talks clearly about, firstly, succession planning is one thing. So that, you know, when a key role player like a chairperson steps down, there shouldn't be this vacuum where no one knows who's going to fill the position. There should actually be someone already identified as having, you know, been put in place to step in for the position of chair when a vacancy arises. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, King IV also talks about a lead independent director. And one of the duties of a lead independent director is to act when the chair is not available or not there. In this instance, and I know many public sector entities don't have a lead independent director, but then let's say a deputy chair, you know, the board charter of the organization could easily stipulate that if the chairperson is not available, the deputy chair steps in as chairperson acting for a period of time so that the board can function.
What do you think the consequences are for the operational capacity of the entity itself as a result of this decision?
So there's a couple of things. I mean, firstly, the board meeting question, we are told the decision was taken there to suspend the CEO. Operationally, there are concerns as to whether the company will continue operating effectively, etc. The one other interesting clause I saw in the Tourism Act, when I read it again this morning in Section 18, Subsection 9, it says very specifically, no decision taken by or act performed on the authority of the board shall be invalid merely because of a casual vacancy on the board. Now, our lawyer friends can weigh in there, but on my non-legal interpretation of that, I feel the suspension of the CEO stands, regardless of whether there was a chair in place or not.
The board, or the board that's been hoofed out now, as far as you understand, does it have any recourse at all?
I think that's a difficult question because, you know, in a governance structure, it is ultimately up to the shareholders who the board members are. The shareholders have authority to appoint directors and to remove directors. There's one clause in the Tourism Act. It says the minister may dissolve the board, but it also says on good cause shown. And I guess that's where our contention is going to be now. I've already seen political parties indicating that they want the minister to account to parliament on this very fact of, you know, whether there was good cause here to remove the board. And I guess that's where it's going to play out now.
In typically, how would you demonstrate good cause, though? I suppose there are a raft of different ways in which you would apply that.
Correct. And it's probably very subjective. Your good cause may be different to my good cause, I guess. You know, ultimately, it's going to be now Parliament holding the minister to account. And let's see if she can convince them that this was the right decision for good reason.
And Pami, it's also about optics, because it's worrying that this governance crisis comes just a month before one of the country's biggest tourism conferences. And that particular sector is vital to the growth of this country. It also comes ahead of the G20.
Yes, I agree. And you know, the optics also of constant instability or perceived instability of an organization, because I went back in the history and I saw in 2023, the whole board was dissolved. In 2024, February of 2024, a new board was appointed. Then in September of that same year, the chair and deputy were removed and a new chair was appointed. That's the chair that now stepped down in July. So that chair didn't even serve for a year. And now we're in August 2025 and the whole board is dissolved again. So you're going to have a whole new brand new set of individuals coming on to serve who have no institutional knowledge to take this organization forward. And yes, they're going to take some time to settle in. And yes, the induction programs, etc., can be put in place. But I also think there's something to be said for a board having a decent run of tenure in order to settle in and fully understand an organization.
Now, look, we don't know how this is all going to end up, but looking forward, are there specific lessons that other state-owned entities should take from this episode to avoid similar governance breakdowns, which we have seen in the past, have we not?
Absolutely. And I think, look, there's a couple of concerns in terms of how appointments are made. So the one I mentioned earlier is generally shareholders appoint a board and the board then chooses their chairperson and deputy chairperson. So that's one of the things that's a little bit clashing in this public sector legislation. The other is also, you know, oftentimes in the public sector, the minister also appoints the CEO in addition to appointing the board. And therefore, you often see CEOs wield a lot of power. And if they're not happy with a board's decision, they can influence a minister to remove a board. So I think that's the other thing. I think key ultimately is there needs to be substance over form. We can't be applying the letter of the law strictly to find these holes to tie people in. You know, we need to be thinking about the intention of the board and the intention of the way the legislation was written. Clearly, there's an intention that the board should be allowed to call a special meeting if it's warranted. And therefore, why pick on the fact that, you know, there wasn't a chairperson at the time when this meeting was called?
And that's where we are going to leave it. Just to add a note to that, I've just got a statement from the Tourism Business Council of South Africa. It says it notes with disappointment the decision to dissolve the Board of South African Tourism. I'm going to thank Professor Pami Natasan, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the Institute of Directors.
Smart Minds, Big Moves, One Summit. Join the country's leading thinkers, doers, and decision makers at the Moneyweb Money Summit. It's happening on the 9th of September at the Sandton Convention Center. It's one full day of powerful insights, real opportunities, and bold conversations shaping South Africa's economic future. And the best part? Your ticket is free. Just use the code MONEYWEBGUEST when you register. Visit moneysummit.co.za now. Moneyweb Money Summit, where smart money moves.
Moneyweb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now let's move on to this. And South Africa's Patriotic Alliance leader and current Minister of Sport, Gayton McKenzie, finds himself under fire. Just days ago, he was loudly criticizing a podcast for what he called offensive remarks about the coloured community. But now it seems the tables have turned. McKenzie is also being investigated by the Human Rights Commission over a string of historic social media posts, some of which contain racially derogatory language. Critics say this exposes a glaring double standard. His supporters argue he's being targeted for political reasons. It is an interesting debate around social media. And where does accountability really lie? And what does it look like in an era where nothing online ever disappears? Well, someone who's been applying his mind to that is Heinrich Weinhardt, who's executive director of the civil society group Cape Forum. So Heinrich, a very warm welcome. And maybe let's start with this. Do you think politicians should be judged on historic tweets, even if they claim a couple of years later they have changed?
I think every South African or every person should be judged on what they posted, regardless of how long ago it is, because if there's no proof that that person has changed, or if that person cannot prove to us that what has been posted however many years ago is no longer the belief of that person, then we have a reason to interrogate the statements made. To play victim, such as Minister McKenzie is trying to do here, is, as far as I'm concerned, the wrong approach. He is actually being offered an opportunity to show responsible leadership, own up to what you said or did in the past, and talk about correcting that, or talk about remedial action or thinking in a way that will unite South Africans. But it is very dangerous, and we should always be suspicious when a politician tries to cast a Chapter 9 organization, a watchdog organization, in the way that the minister is doing by accusing them of some political agenda. The fact is, he is actually doing that. He is playing or trying to portray himself as a martyr.
Do you think there is a line between accountability, as you're suggesting, and what could also be a political witch hunt?
There is definitely a line between the two. But what I'm cautioning against is to paint a Chapter 9 watchdog organization in the same way as you would do with your political opponent. So if the EFF and Action SA and whoever else is calling for action being taken against Minister McKenzie, then you may have some reason for some suspicion that a political campaign against him is at play, not when he refers to the Human Rights Commission.
So the minister's stance on the podcast about offensive remarks about the coloured community in South Africa, do you think those, against the backdrop of what he said in the past, make it lose all credibility?
It cannot lose all credibility. And in that regard, I support the minister. What has been said is based on ugly stereotypes about the coloured community. And the response to it was exactly what it should have been. For coloured people, and may I add, also African people, speaking out against it. What was amiss, Jeremy, was reaction from the white community. And I hold the belief that stereotypes primarily come from what black people have been fed by white people about coloured people, and vice versa.
So as far as the Human Rights Commission, Heinrich, is concerned now, how do you think they should be approaching this? Should it be on the conduct around the podcast or his historic posts?
It should include both. The weight that you give to either one determines the outcome. But remember, the minister will have an opportunity to put his case to the commission. It's an inquiry. It is an opportunity for him to convince the panel that he has moved on from what he said in the past, that he regrets what he said in the past. And then that shouldn't then exclude him from having the right to condemn latter-day or present-day racism from wherever it comes and aimed at whoever the target is.
Let me pick you up on that phrase, moved on. The line that he's using, I've changed. Do you think that is sufficient defense then in public life?
It is to a certain extent. What complicates matters in the case of Gaetan McKenzie is the fact is that the more he speaks about this, the more he makes us question whether real change has taken place. For instance, the minister says Black African people should not claim the K word as an insult to them. Because in the colored community, he says, African-speaking colored community, very often a person with the kind of skin tone that he has is being called the K word as a sort of a nickname and everybody laughs at it.
So Heinrich, how do you think communities then should be reacting to this? Would it be outrage? Would it be forgiveness or a degree of skepticism?
There should be an element of all three. So there should be outrage, but the aim should always be to find a way to bring us all closer together, as opposed to by your statements that you make in defense of yourself, pulling people apart. That's not going to help anyone. And that's unfortunately what the ministry is doing. But let's not focus too much, Jeremy, on the politician. Let's focus also on communities and individuals who on social media and elsewhere have been condemning the podcast in the same way that we should now condemn a young colored learner at Neisner High using the K word in reference to her singing Black African fellow learners. It doesn't matter how young you are or how old you are. It doesn't matter which community you come from. We should respond to it in the same way that we did when the podcast came to the fore.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Heinrich Weinhardt, who's Executive Director of the Civil Society Group Cape Forum.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa's economy is often written off as a disaster, but Old Mutual's group chief economist, Johan Els, is pushing back hard against that label. He argues that the country is showing resilience, that reforms are beginning to take hold, and that commentators who peddle collapse are perhaps missing the full picture. Still, the reality on the ground, I don't need to tell you, is bleak. Unemployment stuck at record highs. There is fragile investor confidence. We do have a weak rand, and households are under pressure. So is Els offering a sober analysis, or is he just glossing over the defense of the indefensible? Johan, a very warm welcome to you. So you say that South Africa is not a disaster, but surely difficult to square that away with things like record unemployment and all the infrastructure hurdles we're facing.
Absolutely. No, there are certainly lots of negatives in South Africa, lots of failures, whether that's in government or state-owned enterprises, lots of failure in terms of policies, etc. No denying that. But I think if we're thinking about investments, we need to think looking forward. And looking forward, I think we have to look at policy changes that we have seen that's being implemented. Operation Vulindlela has done a lot in terms of getting Eskom off the edge of a cliff. So we've done a lot in terms of getting the private sector involved in electricity. Last week, we saw big announcements around private sector getting involved in Transnet's operations. So this is expanding. It's slow. It's not going to have immediate benefits. But I think with the bigger role of the private sector in those spaces where the state and state-owned enterprises have failed, we must take that into account. And looking forward, I think we can expect somewhat better economic growth. It's still not going to be great. Jeremy, we're never going to get the 5 or 6% growth that we actually need in South Africa because of skills deficits, labor market issues, etc. But the stuff that is happening will get us off this 1.1% annual average growth over the last 16 years towards around 2.5% to 3% perhaps. And it's going to take a while. Barbara Creasy said, and she's correct, it's going to take a while to implement all of these. But But we're working on these. We're not just letting them go anymore.
You talk then about evidence of reform starting to take hold, but I guess the big question is whether this is sustainable in the medium to longer term.
I think once you start with a project where you allow the private sector these roles, think about all the private sector investments in electricity generation, the wind farms, the solar farms, etc., it's going to be more and more difficult to turn that around. And we see more and more efforts from government, from Operation Vulindlela, in allowing competition in the electricity market. So I think you're right that we doubt these things, because we've come through a 15-year period of slow and very little policy implementation. But things are happening, and once you start allowing the private sector that bigger role, it's going to be very difficult indeed to turn that around.
And you remain confident then that these reforms that government has failed to deliver on for years is now starting to show some fruit, that that sustainability, that momentum is possible. Where are the risks, though?
Yeah, the risks are certainly that we fall back, that as we've seen so often, that we lose the momentum. But there's very strong efforts from Operation Vulindlela. In their quarterly update reports, we see that things are happening. And I'll be the first to admit it's still too slow. Mm. It's still not enough. The magnitude isn't enough. But when I look at all the reforms that is busy being implemented, the work, as I say, that Operation Vulindlela is doing to push this forward, and I've been impressed by the Department of Transport and the minister there in terms of the efforts ongoing there. So I just see positive momentum, even though it's still too slow.
And Johan, how much of a barometer is a relatively resilient rand right now in terms of what is happening?
Yeah, that's very difficult. The rand is much weaker than what it's supposed to be, according to just the basic fundamentals of inflation differentials. But so the rand is probably pricing in a lot of the negatives in South Africa. But we do see some recovery in the rand, I think mostly on the back of a weaker dollar. But if we look forward in terms of what most people are expecting for the dollar to remain fairly weak, in the face of concerns about the U.S. as a safe haven investment, the sort of banana republic stuff that's happening. If you don't like the employment numbers, you fire the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Stats. Those kind of issues, plus fiscal issues around debt, etc. So the dollar is likely to remain weaker for much longer. And then locally, as we've talked about those policy reforms, somewhat better growth, somewhat easier to fix the fiscal situation. Lower inflation target, certainly, because that lowers the differential between us and the US, for instance. So I think the rand can come back quite a bit. We saw in the period lockdown of 2020, when the rand was 19.90 to the dollar, it came back to 13.50 within 15 months. That's the type of recovery that we can expect in the rand. I don't think a 13 handle is likely, but certainly a 16 or perhaps even a 15 handle in the short term. And then it'll drift again, but with better growth, with a lower inflation target, with less risk on the fiscal side. Ratings agencies, in my opinion, behind the curve in terms of the expectations of the debt to GDP ratio. So we can expect some upgrades in the next few years. So I think the rand can possibly also be slightly more stable in the medium to longer term than what we've become accustomed to.
And finally, Johan, investor confidence, though, does remain weak. Doesn't that undermine to an extent your argument?
It certainly remains weak. But in an era where you see investors willing to take on more risk in emerging economies, when they're not so happy about the U.S., and especially with the U.S. rate cut cycle to restart pretty soon, I think investors will still look at South Africa. Not a failed state. If we look at a whole bunch of fundamentals and compare ourselves to other emerging markets of similar stature, the sort of countries that foreign investors compare us with, then we're not the worst in the grouping in terms of corruption. We certainly have got lots of corruption, but we're not the worst in terms of those countries. And then investors are still very well aware, the foreign investors that I speak to, in terms of the strength of the SA system. The strong constitution, the sophisticated financial sector, strong institutions in terms of the Reserve Bank and Treasury, that the checks and balances that's built in here, that we can get some of those capital flows into emerging economies. Yes, the big issue remains the lack of growth, but then if investors look forward and they've got a decent time horizon, then they also realize that this bigger role of the private sector in the economy can get us towards a better growth path. Not great, but better compared to where we were.
Johan Els is the Group Chief Economist at Old Mutual. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, in an emergency, every second counts. I guess that's pretty obvious. Every single message matters. But for years, Johannesburg's emergency responders have battled with radio dead zones. That has meant calls dropped, coordination breaking down, and lives are at risk. But now there is a change. New hybrid systems are being touted as a fix, which would give officers, firefighters, and paramedics the ability to share live video, GPS location, and real-time updates from the field. All well and good. The question is whether these technologies can truly transform safety on the ground, or whether gaps in coverage remain, whether there's a cost implication, and whether there are issues around capacity. Let's try and answer some of those questions. I'm in conversation now with Cedric Mark Rigney from Hytera South Africa. It's a global two-way radio manufacturing company. Cedric, a very warm welcome. Let's get some background, first of all. How serious are these risks created by the dead zones, and what causes them?
When officers are on the ground, as you clearly said earlier, the importance of getting the message through at the right time is critical in saving lives. So Hytera understands this, and we've adopted a device that it makes it possible to roam between legacy narrowband radios. So this is the old radio networks that public services have invested in over the years, but now due to issues and long maintenance and vandalism, as we see that's happening a lot in our infrastructure, it leaves the officers' lives at risk when they enter a zone where there's no radio coverage. So our radios addresses this shortfall by implementing technology where radio senses the lack of signal, and it switches over from the legacy to a radio network onto an LTE-based radio network seamlessly. So the use of that becomes really transparent from the user side. It's automatic switch over. The user just presses the same PTT button, and automatically the audio is routed back to the same location as his previous career.
So, Cedric, live video and GPS, it sounds powerful in theory, but tell me how reliable this is in practice during a major incident. Have you got data to support that?
Yes. So we provide different levels of this type of solution. The highest level of the mobile press-to-talk functionality is called Mission Critical Services. That, in cooperation with the mobile network operator, guarantees the quality of service to first responders. When they are arriving on the scene, the first responders, they are guaranteed bandwidth so that everyone else busy taking phones and WhatsApp messages, first responders are guaranteed a higher level of access, so that it does provide a higher quality to the first responders offering a guaranteed service.
Are there safeguards that exist to prevent outages or network failures, though, from creating new risks for those in the field?
This does largely depend on the mobile network operators, because we only providing the access to that network. The mobile network operator, however, does need to provide backup redundancy within the local base station or the local mobile network station.
And that doesn't always happen, though, Cedric. So a risk does still remain, doesn't it?
It does still. When we always look at mobile data as a failover to the narrowband voice, narrowband voice still remains mission critical. That is still the critical means of communications. Voice and video, we view it as a secondary network. So we refer to it as narrowband voice with an overlay of PTT on an LTE layer. hope that answers the question.
Surveillance, it does. Surveillance, Cedric, also raises privacy concerns. How do you draw the line between safety and intrusion?
Okay, so all our surveillance video software solutions are POPI compliant. The sharing of that information is basically encrypted at the control room level, and it's controlled by much higher level of user access and passwords and user login and password protected. So not everyone has got this information. Unlike if people are using their cell phones, there is sharing of that information on social media. But these devices, it is encrypted. It only goes through to the control room. So it is actually quite protected.
So far, Cedric, has Johannesburg's move to a hybrid system reduced response time?
Yes, it has. So there's a lot of the technology from the minute the call gets answered. The call gets, if I call in with my as a user using my cell phone, I've called in, let's say, a couple of times before, my information by means of caller ID automatically gets pre-populated on the incident call. They already, you've reduced 10 to 20 seconds, maybe 30 seconds, capturing my information. That information then gets passed on to a dispatcher, radio dispatcher, the exact same information, with a call, the incident type, the severity. After the dispatcher receives the incident type, the dispatcher looks on a map and can see the note that the closest responded to the incident at that specific address. Clicks on that responder on the icon, whether it is a SWAT team or a high-speed chase, high-speed unit for freeway patrol, or an ambulance, clicks on that icon and automatically dispatches that incident to that user in the field. So in essence, you've already reduced call time and incident dispatching.
Just a final one. It would be your intention, I imagine, for the technology to improve accountability and even public trust. But surely it also just adds another layer of cost.
No, I don't think it's a layer of cost. I think with the our responders, our 10111 or our call centers, they actually require this type of solution. A lot of the call centers aren't enabled with types of technology that allow information such as video, text, all the digital applications to be collected at the control room level. So in time, we see that control rooms will become data-driven, built in with a lot of power of intelligence, of information. And from there, you can actually deduct and look at the trends in crime, in response times, and in time, reduce the times and the incidents. Have proactive policing, whereas let's say 5 o'clock on a Friday evening, there's an accident at this specific corner. The trend can be produced on a report, and the law enforcement can take proactive measures. Let's say at 4 o'clock. Deploy different police or traffic officials a kilometer down the road, thereby reducing incidents.
It'll be very interesting to see how this plays up. Cedric Mark Rigney, thank you very much indeed. He speaks for Hytera. It's a global two-way radio manufacturing company. I do appreciate your time. Thank you. And that is where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.